Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 15, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Koontz v. St. Johns River Water Management District. My name is Christian Corrigan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome Mr. James Burling, Director of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation. A more complete bio was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Mr. Burling, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Today we're going to talk about what happened in the Supreme Court at the oral argument for Koontz versus St. John's Water Management District. It was a very hot bench, but before I get into the details of the argument, let me back up a number of years and talk about the cases that led up to this case. The grandfather of regulatory taking exaction cases is Nolan versus California Coastal Commission. In Nolan versus California Coastal Commission, a couple, Marilyn and Patrick Nolan, wanted to build a home on their beachfront lot. There was a ramshackle bungalow in that home, but they wanted to get permission to replace that bungalow with a two-story home in line when keeping with the other homes up and down the beach. Patrick Nolan went to the Coastal Commission because it was development in the coastal area and he needed a coastal permit. And the Coastal Commission was all too happy to give him a permit. But Patrick Nolan, being a city attorney in Los Angeles, looked at the conditions that the Coastal Commission was imposing. And the conditions said that the Nolans would have to give up one-third of their property between the new house and the beach to the public, so the public could pass and repass along that property. Now, Patrick Nolan realized that he was a mere city attorney. He couldn't afford a fight too high up to fight it, and he actually thought, well, I can't fight City Hall or I can't fight the Coastal Commission, and he gave the permit in at the desk of the Coastal Commission, signed it and gave it to them. That's an important piece of information to keep in mind, because later that morning he opened up the legal newspaper and read a case called Pacific Legal Foundation versus California Coastal Commission, where we had beaten the California Coastal Commission in another case. And he said, wait, you can fight the Coastal Commission. You can fight these people. I'm going to give Pacific Legal Foundation a call. He called us. And he told us that he had just signed this permit, and we told him we think it's too late because under California law, as in many other states, once you agree to the conditions of a permit, it's too late to challenge them. He said, let me see about something. Let me see if I can call you back. At his lunch hour, he went back to the Coastal Commission headquarters and went to the woman behind the desk and said, you know, I filed a permit earlier today, and I might have made a mistake. May I look at it? She went through the papers, found it, handed it back to him. He looked at it and said, yeah, I made a mistake. He walked out the door, tore the permit up, and called us and said, I think you got a case now. And indeed, we did represent him. But the important thing is, as we represented him in that case, he had actually never obtained the permit because he took it away from the counter, and as far as the law was concerned, that he had never obtained that permit. An important point, keep in mind, keep that in mind when I talk about Koontz. So the Coastal Commission argued that it had a right to demand this condition, that he give up one-third of his beachfront property, because the building of a two-story home where there used to be a one-story home would create, in the words of the Coastal Commission, and I quote, a psychological barrier to people realizing the existence of the coast. What does that mean? That means that somebody driving down Highway 1, looking in the direction of the ocean, they would see a two-story home where there used to be a one-story home, and that would create a psychological barrier to them realizing the existence of the ocean. I can't make this stuff up. That's what the Coastal Commission said. Of course, we take our psychological barriers important in California, and he lost the case in the California Court of Appeal. But he did ask us to petition the United States Supreme Court for cert. Supreme Court granted the case in 1987, and in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, the court called what the Coastal Commission was trying to do a, quote, out-and-out plan of extortion, end quote. The argument was, and what the holding of the Supreme Court was, that the condition that Nolan was required to give up, one-third of his beachfront property between the home and the ocean, would do nothing to ameliorate the psychological barrier caused by developing this project, because people driving down Highway 1, looking toward the ocean, seeing a two-story house where there used to be a one-story house, wouldn't be able to see the land that he had to give up, that he and his wife had to give up to the state in order to get his permit. And the justices said that is simply a plan of extortion. There is no relationship, no nexus between the impact caused by the development of his home, the loss of the view, and the condition, the giving up of the property. Because there is no relationship, no nexus, it's an unconstitutional violation of the takings clause. Pretty clear case. Move forward a couple of years where you had another case, Dolan versus City of Tigard. In this case, a woman wanted to expand a plumbing store in the City of Tigard, Oregon. She wanted to do that and pave 28 parking spaces. And the city said, here's your permit. We're only asking for two conditions. Condition number one is that you build and construct a bicycle path across your property. That is to ameliorate increased traffic caused by a larger store. Number two, we want you to dedicate a floodway on the other side of your house, between your house and a creek, and make that accessible to the public. That will ameliorate the increased flooding impact potentially caused by the paving of parking spaces, creating more impervious cover. Mrs. Dolan refused, and she never took the permit, but she did challenge it in court. That also went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And at one time at oral argument, one of the justices said in response to the idea that the bicycle path is going to ameliorate impact caused by greater traffic from a larger store, the justice had never seen people with plumbing parts on bicycles and the bike paths around where he lived, and he strongly doubted that people were going to go to and from the store to pick up plumbing supplies and carry them back on a bicycle. And in that case, the court held that the condition was unlawful and it violated the takings clause, because even though there was some relationship between traffic and the bicycle path, between the flood easement and the increase in impervious parking spaces, the conditions were not, quote, roughly proportional, end quote, to the impact caused by the development. The city, under Nolan and Dolan, had the burden of proof of proving, first of all, that there is rough proportionality between the bicycle path and increased traffic, and second, that there is rough proportionality between the more impervious cover and a floodway easement that not only prevented the development of the floodway, but invited people to trace back and forth on that formerly private property. And the court had a lot of trouble saying, even if you have increased impervious cover and it creates a flooding danger, why is that ameliorated by allowing the people to walk back and forth on this new public land, this new public easement? So those were the two key cases, the Nolan case and the Dolan case. Now, in both of those cases, the thing that was asked for by the government entity was a dedication of land to public use. The easement in the Nolan case and the bike path and the floodway easement in the Dolan case. Conceivably, if the government had asked for money, say the property the Nolans had to give up was worth a couple $100,000, and the Nolans are said, you could have your permit if you give up a couple $100,000, and then we use that money to condemn the property, it shouldn't make any difference. And indeed, in a case called Ehrlich versus City of Culver City, a similar issue was before the court. Here, an owner of a tennis club got permission from the city to go out of business, tear down the tennis club, and tear down the tennis courts, and he donated the nets and the lighting to the city and that kind of thing. He fast-forward a few months, and he submitted a permit to build a condominium project on the site of the former tennis club. And the city of Culver City said, hey, you can have your permit to build the condominium, but we want about $250,000 in exchange so we can build new public tennis courts to ameliorate the loss from the impact of these formerly private tennis courts. And the California courts are saying, well, Nolan and Dolan do not apply because that This is an exaction of money, the $250,000 to buy new tennis courts, whereas in the situation in Dolan and Nolan, they were simply required to give up land. And the Supreme Court, a few days after it issued the ruling in Dolan, issued a ruling on the petition for cert in Ehrlich and sent it back to the U.S. Supreme Court for consideration in light of Dolan. Most people took that as a signal that monetary exactions were indeed to be covered by the Nolan and Dolan standards, but we had no clear holding from the U.S. Supreme Court on that issue. So in the Kuntz case, Coy Kuntz Sr. purchased 14 acres of property outside of Orlando, Florida, approximately 30 years ago. About 18 years ago, he submitted permits to develop the property. He wanted to develop 3.7 out of the 14 acres of property. He wanted to do some small commercial development. St. John's Water Management District has permitting authority over the property, and its mission is to protect wetlands. There are about 11 million acres of wetlands remaining in Florida and about an equal number of uplands in Florida. Florida is a very wet state. And the district had established a 10-to-1 mitigation ratio. In other words, if you fill 1 acre of wetland, then you have to create 10 new acres of wetland. And the district considered at first that the 3.7 acres were wetlands. I should point out, as the case ultimately proceeded, that it was determined by the trial court that these 3.7 acres were indeed largely not wetland. But for the sake of the conditions that were imposed and what was thought at the time the conditions were imposed, the 3.7 acres was considered wetlands by the district. The district, now Coy Kuntz had offered to give up the remaining 11 acres of his property to the district, set it aside as a conservation easement, and when he did that, he thought that could be enough mitigation. But the district said, no, we have a 10-to-1 ratio. You need to give up 37 acres of wetland, and if you only have 11, we want you to spend your money fixing up property belonging to the district. Specifically, 50 acres of property belonging to the district between 4.5 and 7 miles away from the site of this development. We want you to fix culverts and do various things on our property to improve our property. Then we will give you the permit. In the course of negotiations, the district made other suggestions, such as he reduces the size of this development to 1 acre, in which case the 11 acres of mitigation would be adequate, and a few things about how he could develop his property. But ultimately, the final word from the district was that either you do the 11 acres dedication plus off-site mitigation, which is going to cost, according to the district, around $10,000. According to Coy Kuntz's experts, somewhere between $90,000 and $150,000. And if you do those things, we'll give you a permit. Coy Kuntz said, I'm not doing that. I'll give you the 11 acres, but I'm certainly not fixing your property 4.5, 7 miles away from my property, because I don't think there's any relationship under Dolan. And the district denied the permit. He never got the permit. And that's where this case began in court. Over the course of many years, several things happened. After a period of years, the trial court and the Court of Appeals agreed that the land wasn't wetland. It agreed that the reason why the permit was denied because he failed to give this off-site mitigation, the trial court ordered the district to grant a permit. The district ultimately granted a permit, but it took 11 years for Coy Kuntz to get that, and the district court awarded under a particular statute under Florida, a damages provision under Florida, the damages of about $327,000 for the loss of use of the property for 11 years. The district has appealed that, and they appealed that to the Court of Appeal, where in a 2-to-1 decision, Coy Kuntz won, or I should say by this time, his son won, because Coy Kuntz passed on about 10 years ago, and now his son is carrying on this fight. And he won that, and the court affirmed the award of damages under a Florida statute. I must point out this award of damages was not under the takings clause. It was not a federal remedy. It was a state remedy for the violation of Nolan and Dolan. And the Supreme Court has held several times before that a state is authorized to give greater protection for or greater remedies for violations of constitutional rights than federal law may require. So the Florida Supreme Court got a hold of this case, and it ruled two things. First of all, the Florida Supreme Court ruled that the Nolan and Dolan standards did not apply because a mitigation was never imposed against Coy Koontz because he never took the permit. In other words, if he had taken the permit and the conditions were imposed, then he would have a Nolan and Dolan claim. Now, that's problematic for two reasons. The first reason that's problematic is that in many states, you cannot bring a challenge to an exaction if you accept the benefits from the permit. A number of states have that rule. Not all do. It's varies by states, but that would be a difficult rule in many states. But more importantly, for purposes of this case, the fact that Mr. Koontz did not take the permit is somewhat irrelevant to the application of Nolan and Dolan. As you remember, when I started out this discussion, I mentioned that in the Nolan case, permits had never been granted either, and the easement had never been actually taken from him. But he was certainly allowed to take, the Nolans were allowed to take that case up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in the Dolan case, the same thing. The permits had not issued. Mrs. Dolan did not take a permit subject to a condition. She refused to accede to the condition, and therefore the permit was denied. Exact same circumstances in this case. The second reason why the Florida Supreme Court said Nolan and Dolan do not apply here is because under Nolan and Dolan, those were cases where land was taken, dedications of land, the bicycle path, the floodway easement, or the beach easement in the Nolan case, whereas here it was money exactions, and money is not the same thing as land, therefore Nolan and Dolan do not apply. We had two questions presented to the U.S. Supreme Court when we at Pacific Legal Foundation took the case over at that point. We asked, does Nolan and Dolan apply to circumstances where there is no permit actually granted? And do Nolan and Dolan apply to exactions of monetary conditions? We've had some cases where the court has clarified the context of Nolan and Dolan. In Lingle, the court said this is a special circumstance of the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. It's a special circumstance of land use permitting. And in these sort of land use permits, the doctrine applies because we're looking at, on one hand, the ability to use your property is a constitutional right, and the ability to get a permit is a governmental benefit that you're ultimately entitled to because you have a right to use your property. And when you try to exercise that right or obtain the benefit of a permit, and government imposes an unrelated condition, a condition where it's asking you to give up your own property, we believe that's a violation of the Doctrine of Unconstitutional Conditions and Nolan and Dolan. The property that you have to give up, it's not so important whether it's land or money. The fact is, you have to give up property in exchange for a permit that you have an ultimate right to. So it's a rather clear example, we think, of the Nolan and Dolan doctrine. We had briefing last fall and early winter. We had a number of briefs, 9 amicus briefs submitted on the side of the of Coy Koontz Jr. Now the son has taken over the case. In 5 cases, including one from the United States for the Florida's St. John's Water Management District. And we had oral argument today at the Supreme Court. It was a very, very hot bench. Lots of questions on both sides. Somewhat surprising I'm not going to tell you that Justice Thomas asked any questions. He did that yesterday at argument, but he asked no questions today. But the surprise was how Scalia got out of the box asking questions that seemed to express that he had some significant uncertainties about the merits of Coy Koontz's case. We were saying that this was, and I should say that Paul Beard of Pacific Legal Foundation made the argument, and Paul Beard that indicated that, you know, when you have this kind of mitigation measure, you have to have an individualized determination. And Scalia said, for what? Wouldn't the other side argue that you have no cause of action for a taking because nothing's been taken? And Scalia seemed to be under the impression that in Nolan, a permit was granted and the conditions were imposed. We tried to disabuse him of that idea, and I think we did, but it may have taken some time to get there. We had a number of questions from Justice Sotomayor that said, you know, if you look at the record here, the agency considered lots of mitigation measures. It's not clear that it was simply the off-site mitigation that denied the permit. And we think it's clear under the record of the case, but we'll see. Ginsburg began her questioning by saying, oh, you know, you have a problem to counsel Paul Beard for Coy Coons. The record's very clear that the district didn't say take it or leave it. And she said that you had, you know, a half a dozen alternatives that you could look at. Again, it's a little surprising that we're getting so deep into the weeds of the facts of the case, because the facts, we believe, are fairly clear that the reason why the permit was denied was because the conditions were not acceded to, and the particular condition was the one of off-site mitigation. And these sort of weeds shouldn't matter to, I think, the underlying question of whether or not the permit exaction applies, the Nolan and Dolan applies to a denial of a permit when a money exaction is not acceded to. Kagan talked about what if you had a policy saying that an applicant must come forward with a mitigation proposal. And the landowner says, I'm not going to do that. Can the landowner make a takings claim? Again, that's not the facts of this case. If the agency were to put the burden on the other side to come up with a mitigation measure, I would say that does seem to fall in the face or fly in the face of Nolan and Dolan, which puts the burden on the agency to justify the condition under the standard, nexus standard of Nolan and the rough proportionality standard of Dolan. Some questions were asked about, well, what if you had a uniform 10-to-1 policy? You have 100 acres and you want to develop 5, that shouldn't be a problem because you could set aside 50. But what if you have only 1 acre and you want to develop that 1 acre? Can the agency tell them to do 10 acres of mitigation somewhere else? And if so, is that under Nolan and Dolan or not? So all kinds of questions from the other side, looking at the alternatives. Breyer began to spend a good bit of time asking about whether this really falls under Penn Central. Penn Central is a case where the United States Supreme Court looked at a takings challenge brought by the Penn Central Railroad Corporation when it was not allowed to expand the size of an office or build an office tower over the Grand Central Station. And in the Penn Central case, the court said when you're dealing with the question of whether or not land has been taken by regulation in a regulatory taking, you need to look at 3 factors. If it isn't clear that all the use and value has been destroyed or they're not physically invading the property, you need to look at investment expectations, you need to look at the economic impact of the denial, and you need to look at the character of the regulation. And Breyer said, well, I could see a Penn Central claim here, but I don't see why Nolan and Dolan applies here. This could be a Penn Central claim. Well, the problem with that is that under Nolan and Dolan are the special circumstance where a condition is imposed in the permitting process. Penn Central is a case where a regulation allegedly denies use and value of land, and under the balancing test, it goes too far under Justice Holmes' language in Pennsylvania Coal versus Mann. It goes too far and is a taking. But it's clear that Justice Breyer thought this should be considered under the lens of due process. He gave a hypothetical of, you know, say that a project would create something really bad like sliced bread. And then there are some jokes back and forth, well, is sliced bread bad or is sliced bread good? But for the sake of this hypothetical, we consider it bad under this conceptual framework. You know, and he said, well, you know, if this is going to result in something bad, isn't that under Pennsylvania Coal where you're required to or Penn Central. where you'd have to look to see whether it's so bad that it destroys the use and value of your property. So I think we had a great deal of argument, and it seemed to be that the court, the usual liberal wing, Sotomayor, Breyer, Kagan, especially were especially active with Breyer as well, in arguing that there really might not be a Nolan Dolan claim here, but perhaps if there is a claim, it would be under Penn Central. Later on in the argument, Justice Roberts said, well, isn't it true under Penn Central the landowner always loses? And yeah, that is true. So when it came to have the St. John's Water Management District, Roberts began the questioning immediately by saying, you know, you're arguing that there is no Nolan and Dolan analysis for a monetary exaction. Wouldn't that remove all restraint on an agency? He said there'd be no limits in the federal, under the federal constitution, of what an agency can demand. The attorney for St. John's Water Management District said, well, maybe it would, you could have relief under the Due Process Clause or the Equal Protection Clause. And Robert said, but not the one clause that's supposed to protect landowners, the Takings Clause. There were a lot of hypotheticals coming from Roberts and especially Alito on the taking of land, and it was clear to me that Roberts and Alito were very concerned about the rule asked for by the district, because that rule would remove restraints from the government, and the government could ask far too much in such circumstances. The attorney for the district argued that, well, you know, cash is different. Those cases were all about land. And so Scalia said, well, you're saying cash is magical, as if there's something special about cash. If you demand cash, you can get away with it, but you can't get away with it if you demand land. Then Roberts began a football hypothetical. He said, well, suppose, or a football stadium hypothetical, suppose you want to develop property, and you're told by the agency that if, in order to develop your property, you have to build a football stadium for the city. You know, is that wrong? Would that be subject to Nolan and Dolan? And the answer from the district was, well, that would be perhaps, if nobody else is required to do it, a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And so the next question is, well, what if five or six other landowners had to build the same stadium? And again, we get to the question that we get to the point that the Takings Clause is the one clause that could not be used according to the district's argument, and Roberts and Alito were both rather skeptical of that. There was an argument, and Kagan said, well, you know, if you win in this case, then why wouldn't everybody, you have the floodgate argument, everybody would challenge taxes and fees and that kind of thing. But the answer was, and Scalia chimed in, that taxes are only in the landowner in this particular case. This is really not about the taxing power. Scalia, although he was fairly hot in his questions of the landowner, he was equally hot in his questions, if not more so, in his questions of the government attorneys in this case. During this part of the questioning, Breyer went back to Penn Central, saying this should be part of the Penn Central balancing test. And throughout the argument, from then on, we came back to this over and over again, to this football stadium hypothetical. $1 million you have to give up. Instead of building the football stadium, you have to give them $1 million to build the football stadium. Oh, I would submit that's very much like the $250,000 that Mr. Ehrlich had to give up to build a tennis court club for the city of Culver City. Then we had arguing after that from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Needler argued the case, and he also had some, Edwin Needler argued the case. He had some very difficult questions put to him, more about the football stadium. He answered that it could be protected, you know, the football stadium could be taken care of the Equal Protection Clause. Once again, you know, Alito made the remarks of Roberts made the remark that the one area of the Constitution that's supposed to protect landowners, the Takings Clause, wouldn't apply. He seemed to be skeptical of that. Sotomayor had a very long and lengthy question. She and Breyer competed for the length of the question sometimes. And even, you know, in her point was that Nolan and Dolan just don't seem to apply here. But she did ask, well, what if the agency's decision had a written, an express condition? It doesn't matter if there's a grant or denial. In other words, that, you know, whether you grant the permit with a condition or deny the permit without a condition, Mr. Needler, does it really matter? And the government had to admit, the U.S. government had to admit, it really doesn't matter if there was an express condition, and then they went back to the data of whether there's an express condition here. I think that in the end, Alito ended with a question that, so does this mean that Nolan and Dolan are only traps or are really stupid districts? That is, if you knew that if you granted the permit, you'd be subject to Nolan and Dolan, and if you don't grant the permit, you're not going to be subject, well, who's going to grant the permit in such a case? So bottom line, it was a very active bench with lots of questions from both sides. I cannot predict exactly how this is going to turn out. I am guardedly optimistic that we're going. I am fairly optimistic, actually, that we're going to have a decision in the favor of the landowner. The question is, how is it going to be split up? Oh, I should mention, Kennedy asked very few questions, but at the end of the argument in the case in chief for the landowner, Kennedy asked, didn't he think that due process, or where does due process come in? As people who have observed Kennedy over the years in various taking cases, Stop the Beach Renourishment, Eastern Enterprises versus Apfel, and others, he has always seemed rather enamored of finding these cases under the due process clause. That is somewhat problematic because under due process, when we're talking about economic rights under footnote 4 of Caroline Products, you don't get much process. And if the exaction was imposed legislatively, the legislative process is the only process you get. But Kennedy does seem enamored by due process, although he has found there to be violations of the due process clause. Scalia, as most people know who follow him, has no tolerance for due process arguments at all. He doesn't like due process. So are we going to get a 4-1-4 decision, as there was in a prior case called Eastern Enterprises versus Apfel, where four of the justices say it's a violation of the takings clause, and Justice Kennedy says it's a violation of due process? Hard to say, but I think it's going to be a fractured decision. I think it's going to take a while for the decision to come out, and I think we're all going to have to look very carefully at what the decision actually says to see what this means, because the implications of this case are rather significant. Because if Coy Kuntz loses, then on either ground, then districts and other folks or other government agencies are simply not going to grant permits. They're going to say, well, you can take this permit with these conditions or go home, and we're not subject to judicial review. Or instead of asking for land conditions, they're just going to ask for money to do the same thing. And if there is no real restraint, meaningful restraint on government agencies, they will treat landowners like ATM machines. Many districts and agencies are treating developers like ATM machines already anyway, because many landowners, many developers, do not want to litigate these cases for X number of years. It's very frustrating and time-consuming. But nevertheless, at least there are some constitutional restraints. There were arguments made in the briefing that the sky would fall for government if they lost this case. Well, they made the same arguments in Dolan, and they made the same arguments in Nolan, and government agencies are able quite well to impose conditions on development. All they need to do is prove that the conditions are related in a roughly proportional manner to impacts caused by the project. It shouldn't be that hard. But this case is going to be a difficult case. With that, that's the end of my summary of the background, and hopefully we'll have some questions that can go into more detail on what happened at oral argument, or more detail about the background of this case, or some of the prior takings-related cases dealing with unlawful condition or the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burling. I will now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say, the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say, your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor. We will be answering questions in the order in which they are received. While we're waiting for our first question, I just want to remind you that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be tomorrow, Wednesday, January 16th at 1 p.m., and we will host another From the Courthouse Steps Teleforum on City of Arlington versus FCC and the question of who determines agency jurisdiction with Karen Harned, Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Business Legal Center. Also this week, on Thursday, January 16th at 2 p.m., we will host a Teleforum discussion on the future of publicly owned lands featuring Professor Donald Koshin of Chapman University Law School and David Garbett, staff attorney for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Well, Mr. Berling, while we're waiting for the first question, I noticed the Department of Justice in their brief, they spent a lot of time distinguishing exaction takings and other forms of takings. Were any of the justices impressed by this? And how difficult was it for them to distinguish it?
I think some of the justices really couldn't see why these circumstances here fit within the exaction takings rubric of Nolan and Dolan. And as I said, Justice Breyer asked a number of questions. Why isn't this simply a Penn Central case? And I think some of those justices were somewhat interested in the concerns or the issues raised by the Department of Justice brief. The idea that Nolan and Dolan is a difficult doctrine. When it first came out, we thought it was arising perhaps out of a case called Agins versus City of Tiburon, where the court said that you had a regulatory taking when a regulation fails to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest. The court later said in Lingle versus Chevron that, you know, the Agins test of something that fails to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest is really a takings case. But Nolan and Dolan, it said, it continues to be a special circumstance of the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions. Despite the court in Lingle upholding or continuing the vitality of Nolan and Dolan, there are those folks, and the Justice Department was playing upon that question whether there should be a takings claim, a takings issue when you have an exaction. And when you have either you have a takings claim or you have a due process, and in a situation like this, maybe you don't really have the Nolan and Dolan analysis applicable.
Great. And we have our first question on the line.
Hi, I'm from Indiana. I've practiced law for about 40 years now. And about a good part of it was spent in municipal law on both sides of the table. In any event, in Indiana we have something called developmental contracts, which really amounts to with a plan commission or zoning board, which really amounts to what we used to call contract zoning, which used to be illegal, but now it's been blessed as legal. How do you think, it's very widespread, and this business about extracting things from developers goes on very widely, as I'm sure everybody who's listening knows, and it's used manipulatively by government bureaucrats to extract new playgrounds and green areas and this, that, and the other. And from my point of view, it always seemed terribly unfair and should be unconstitutional. I'm wondering if you think that this will decision could have a substantial impact on the things that are going on with contract zoning. They're calling them by different names, but that's what it really is.
No, I understand. In many jurisdictions, for example, they call them development agreements. And it's, of course, an agreement perhaps at the end of a gun in some kind. If you want your permit, you have a couple of choices. You can reach a mutually acceptable agreement with us where we'll give you the permit and you give us X, Y, Z plus A through L. Now, If you do not agree to go through the development agreement process, you can go through the normal process and try to get a permit and see what conditions they can impose. Now, development agreements probably are not going to go away, or this contract zoning is probably not going to go away no matter what happens in the case today. As long as Nolan and Dolan are out there, that does provide some constraint on what government can ask. But most governments realize that if they can corner a developer and demand all kinds of things that may or may not be justifiable under Nolan and Dolan, many developers would prefer to go that route rather than the route of challenging a denial of a permit or challenging the imposition of an exaction as a condition for a permit, because that takes time and money, et cetera, et cetera. So a victory in this case would make it a little easier for landowners, because it'll give them a little more leverage to say that you can't ask for too much or I'm going to sue as a violation of the takings clause. But it's still not going to prevent developers and local governments from getting together in a room and hammering out the details of a development agreement, when that might be a quicker and more expeditious, if not more expensive, route to go than the litigation route.
Again, to request the floor and ask a question, please press star and then the pound key. Mr. Burling, while we've got you here and we're waiting for the next question, there have been several commentators, one including Richard Epstein, who have said that the environmental mitigation doctrine amounts to nothing more than a form of, I think, grand theft larceny is what he called it, and called upon the court to reject it once and for all. Did you get any sense from any of the questions that there might be at least one justice who would be willing to go in that direction?
You know, I don't think any of the justices are ready, willing, or able to go that far. I read the article by Richard Epstein, and I like the article. But as a practical matter, this court has enough trouble in these property right cases to get five votes together. And in an ideal world, the court would recognize, as Epstein pointed out, what a sham that these mitigation measures are. I mean, I alluded to the fact earlier that this 10-to-1 ratio is pretty much drawn out of the air. You have different agencies that apply different mitigation measures under different circumstances, anywhere from 1-to-1 to 3-to-1 to 10-to-1 to 30-to-1. You know, it's all over the book, and all it is over-regulating in the first place and then trying to demand a pound of flesh from the landowners. And Epstein put it very well in his article. I recommend people, search it on the web, because it's quite entertaining and interesting to read. But I do not see the court really getting at that. There were no questions speaking to the underlying validity of those. Yeah, there was at a point where it was mentioned toward the end of the argument that, we have 11 million acres of wetland in Florida, we have 11 million acres of upland, and there seems to be a little bit of skepticism about the idea that you have to mitigate 10-to-1 for this kind of thing, because, why isn't this something that should be looked at? Everybody should have to take care of this, because if you've got 11 million acres of wetland left and 11 million acres of upland, then there's not enough wetland for a 10-to-1 mitigation measure. So why do we have the scheme that we do? Be that as it may, I as much as I wish that the court would seriously consider the arguments raised by Richard Epstein, they really weren't before the court. Sure, the fact that people today owning wetlands have to mitigate for the fact that everybody has filled them in the past and now they're the last ones holding the last undeveloped wetlands, it seems unfair. It seems like the burden should be borne by everybody. If you want to protect the wetlands, the public ought to buy them. But that really wasn't the issue that was before the court.
Great. Well, I'll open it up for one last opportunity. If anyone would like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Again, I'll remind everyone that our next Teleforum call is tomorrow, Wednesday, January 16th at 1 p.m. We'll host another court from the Courthouse Steps Teleforum on City of Arlington versus FCC, as well as a Teleforum on Thursday, January 16th at 2 p.m. on the future of publicly owned lands, featuring Professor Donald Koshin of Chapman University and David Garbutt, staff attorney for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And we do have one more question.
Thank you. I found your recounting of kind of the history of those cases and how they came to be what they are and came to the court to be very interesting. But it seems to me there's a sort of a disconnect between the political discussion about the takings and what's going on in the court and the way that the court reasoning is taking place. I wonder if you could comment on how those two might be connected up somehow so that the a larger population than merely the legal community can influence the takings clause, which on its face it reads pretty simply, and that's, I think, the way most Americans read it.
Yeah, let me try to answer your question. I'm not sure I fully answer your question about the disconnect politically, but the fact is that everybody who owns property in this country has, you know, something of a dilemma here. If you want to get a permit to use your property, it's one thing to ask you to take care of increased harms or burdens that may be caused by your use of the property. You know, if you're seriously going to have an adverse public impact, you may be required to take care of that impact. But so often what we see today are local communities and districts using the permit process to get whatever they can out of a landowner. So you want to add an addition to your house, you have to plant trees and you have to, you know, go into the tree fund so that you can buy more trees in the state park down the street. And if the public were more aware that their rights are being held hostage, if they want to put their property to some new or different use, or even potentially continue an existing use if it's non-conforming under new zoning, you know, the public might be concerned about that. You know, fundamentally, what's going on in this case is a sense of unfairness, that the landowner is being singled out to bear a burden which, in all fairness and justice, should be borne by everybody. The fact that you want to develop your property doesn't mean that you're the one that should be stuck with building new schools, firehouses, or parks, unless it can be demonstrated that your building a house creates a need for all of these things and that the need is roughly proportional. But so often you just look at the permitting process as a way for government to get more so it can spend more. While the public might like the idea that government spends more without putting taxes on the individual, fundamentally it's unfair, and as long as we're a nation of landowners and property owners and homeowners, people should be concerned about it.
Well, Mr. Burling, before we end, would you like to close with any parting thoughts or anything else that you think that our audience should take away from this case?
I think the audience should be quite interested in seeing what happens when the case comes out. I expect this will be one of those things that comes out at the end of the term, considering the varied questions from all sides and the fact that it was such a very hot bench. And I think that anybody in the contemplating obtaining a permit or trying to develop a little property should be very concerned about whether the vitality of Nolan and Dolan remained after this case. This is a difficult case for the court to decide, and where the court's going to go on property rights in the future is probably going to depend in large part on how the coalitions form and come down in this case. So I think this is going to be a fascinating case to look at when it comes down.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for your expert opinion here today, and thank you also to our audience. Please do join us tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern for our From the Courthouse Steps telephone call on City of Arlington versus FCC. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.